how the state was.
Because the way I thought about this was the key fact was that he, you know, I mean, the two theories at trial was suicide by cop or intended to assault the cops or shoot them. And so the fact that he was reaching down there was of significance, but the police officer observed that irrespective of any statements the defendant made.
And I think that what I would, how I'd respond to that, Your Honor, is to point out the two different statements that you have. Because if you recall, this somehow lasted 3 days of this trial with, I think, 5 witnesses. And there are 2 police officers that testified, one of whom says what I think is consistent with what you're saying, is the hand was at the back of the cushion. He did make a statement. The attorney objected to it. That's on page, I believe, 221 of the appendix. And there was a statement made about, I think he was, you know, something kind of speculative that the attorney did object about. He said, and in terms of trying to gain control of his arm and pull them around where we could control them, his position on the couch, it seemed to me like one of his arms was down behind these cushions. There's the objection, that objection is sustained, and then he says the hand is at the back of the cushion. Now the evidence, as you recall, is that the handle is at the front. They have him down, and they say maybe he's reaching towards the back. That contradicts the testimony from Officer, I think that's Officer Breeding that says that, and then Officer Thompson says, I don't remember, it all happened really quickly, but I believe I had both of his hands. Because they said he was reaching maybe towards the Coke can that was on the little table that's in between, and at that point, they see their opportunity, they jump towards him, and Officer Thompson says, I think I had both his hands. They get him off, they take him outside of the house. And when they're talking, if you go back to page 221 of the appendix, when they're talking with him, and he says the hand's at the back of the cushion, which is not consistent with where the knife was being placed, they then immediately ask him questions about, well, what did he say? What did he say to you? And that would be the objectionable statements. What did he say? Well, he said he wanted to see if I was going to be a trooper, and other statements like that. And I think if you look there and then you look at how were these statements used throughout the remainder of the trial, the Commonwealth is relying on those statements both in response to the motion to strike that was made and then also relying pretty heavily on those statements in its closing argument.
Yeah, I mean, they don't put the defendant in a great light in the sense that, you know, he gives a sarcastic answer to why his hand was dangling in front of that. He was scratching himself and that kind of thing. All right. But it, you know, it's one. Suppose he had said, "Yeah, I was reaching for the knife. I was going to stab you," or I mean, something like that. But that's not, you know, there's none of that.
Well, the statements I think are, "I wanted to see what you would do." There's an, I would imagine, what the Commonwealth argues is an adoptive admission or admission by silence. But a reasonable person would have responded, "No, that's not what I was doing." But he doesn't say anything. And their argument during closing, and this is on in the appendix at 430, 454 through 455, and then 459 through 461, they argue that's an admission. They said, "I wanted to see." He said he wanted to see what we would do if we went for the handle. Not to mention the 5 times that Eric Breeding went after him and asked him on that tape, and he didn't respond to it. And that's when the defendant doesn't deny it. And then he gave multiple different versions of what happened on his ride to the station. And just for a moment, let's pretend that he didn't tell the officers he didn't intend to commit suicide by cop. And so the question, obviously, I don't think there's a question with respect to deficient performance. I think there's a question with respect to the prejudice. I think that's what the government, or the Commonwealth, excuse me, is responding to. And again, I think you have to look at that. And I would imagine this case was granted based on the Fourth Circuit's, the Gruninger case there, and a similar case, a similar type situation, where you have a potential Edwards argument with respect to statements and invocation of counsel not made. The attorney attempts to make it in the middle of trial in the Hanover Circuit Court and is told, well, you didn't timely file it. And then those statements come in. Similarly,
Mr. Sheldon, may I ask you a question? First of all, let me thank you for accepting the court's appointment.
My pleasure, sir.
It's a very... You know, we talk about lawyers coming up to the plate and doing their bit to help the indigents. Thank you for doing your bit. The one thing that a lot of things concern me about this case, but the one thing that concerns me about your position is that the defendant testified. And I think you would concede that if the defendant testifies on the same subject, the statements that may very well have been subject to suppression are now admissible.
admissible for impeachment purposes.
Right.
For impeachment.
So how, knowing that that's the case, how, to follow up on Justice McCullough, where is the prejudice? There may be deficient performance, but if these statements are admissible on the same subject, how is there prejudice?
Well, I think I guess as I responded earlier, you have to look at it in the whole. So you have these statements that are coming in, they're being argued, they're being focused upon. He certainly testified. But they are able to then argue in their closing argument, not that what he has testified is not credible because there's some impeachment evidence of statements he made inconsistent, because the jury presumably would have been instructed that the statements that he made previously can be considered not for the truth of the statements that he made earlier, but as impeaching what he's saying now. It's difficult for me not to want to, I guess, Monday morning quarterback this, for lack of a better phrase, as an attorney, and say, perhaps I would have moved to suppress these statements and then put on the evidence with respect. I think there was a friend that testified, I don't recall her name, that said leading up to this incident he was despondent. There were a lot of things going on in his life. Based on statements that he made to me, I was going to be taking care of his dog, I was going to be looking after his father. And then the evidence that was presented with respect to he got to the jail, he was placed in suicide watch, and then make that argument. The other kind of flip side of that is there, as I explained, or as I told my belief to Justice McCullough, is you have this discrepancy between the statements of the officers with respect to whether he was reaching in that area or what he was doing. A motion to suppress, if those statements are not admissible and then he does not testify, and I don't know that I necessarily saw any benefit to him testifying, nor did I see any benefit to him calling the police to his own home and inviting them in and doing any of the things that he did that day. But I think if you have these statements and they're suppressed and he's not testifying, he can still make this argument. If he does still testify, those statements aren't coming in as admissions, they're coming in as their impeachment purposes, and they're not being offered for the truth of the matter. Certainly does not help with his credibility, nor does his record or any other things that were referenced there. The argument that's made in Gruninger is that a confession has this damaging, devastating effect on a trial. And that is really was the focus of a lot of what the Commonwealth's argument was. And understandably so, because of all the statements that were made. I think that the attorney certainly recognized that there was an issue when he attempted to raise the issue. He called it with respect to voir dire and voir dire the witness and asking questions about whether or not his rights had been read and then trying to bring it up. And it almost seemed as if maybe the prosecutor thought this might come up. Because he very quickly says, no, this code section says this and this is what you need to do. And it was the motion was filed. And I guess my concern on behalf of Mr. Witt is he did raise this issue in his habeas, and the court just summarily dismissed it. The attorney made no reference in his affidavit whatsoever offering any explanation. Was it a matter of sound trial strategy? Did he say, well, we were going to call him as a witness, and those things may have come in, they may have impeached him. The other issue is whether or not it prejudiced him to the extent that some of those statements might have affected how a jury viewed him with respect to punishment. And that's also another aspect of what happened here. So I think that when you're looking at what's the standard, is there a meritorious claim? Does that have some substance? I think it certainly does. And then the reasonable probability of a different outcome. And that's really, I would submit that is the issue. Where is the prejudice? And I would again just point the court to where or how the Commonwealth is using these issues. There is, like I said, a conflict in the officer's testimony. And the issues really are with respect to his awareness of that night, with his statements about why he was going for it and seeing if they were going to be a trooper. So I would just, at this point, if there are no other questions, I'll just reserve the balance of my time.
All right.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. Let me first point out that it's not the attorney's fault that no reference to this issue appears in the affidavit. Of course, I request an affidavit from him. And at that point, I believe the issue to be exclusively a failure to follow through on the motion to suppress the knife. And if you look at the motion that the defendant references at page 86 to 87 of the appendix, that's exactly what that motion talks about. It is an effort in discussing it in his original habeas. He did mention the statements, but said only that those statements were improperly obtained, and they supported the search warrant for the knife. And as a consequence, the knife should not be admitted. So I read the issue to be merely, I don't want the knife to come in. The reasons why the knife shouldn't come in are following, including that the statements you relied upon were not properly used to obtain that evidence.
But I can't imagine any basis upon which a motion to suppress the knife would be successful.
Yes, sure.
I mean, it just defies credulity to think that that would happen. It's the statements that are the issue. As far as I'm concerned, suppress the knife is a loser from the start.
Yes, sure. No question about it. That's why we didn't address it seriously. It was a losing issue. We didn't need input from the attorney. Now, if you find it to be a different issue, I think that we can proceed to the merits here. And the first point with the merits is that the attorney knew he had to call Mr. Waite as a witness. What we have up without Mr. Waite is the tape. The events of these crimes are recorded. They're on the tape playing for the jury. They heard him make all these threats to kill the officers, and nothing subtle about that. He said, "I'm going to kill you. When I reach, somebody's going to die." So no question that, and that we also had on the tape the efforts to strangle him, and we had the testimony from the officer that what he actually said was that he was going to the back, at the back of the seat, going for whatever was under the cushion. So we had testimony of the threats, we had testimony of his effort to reach the weapon. I think the attorney had to present Mr. Witt as a witness. And if that was true, there was no point in moving to suppress the statements, since they would, in any event, come in as cross-examination. The attorney also, I think, wanted to use some of the things that were in the statement. As you may remember, the defense, one of the defenses was that he wanted the police officers to shoot him, to engage in suicide by cop. During the challenge statements, the officer had asked him, "Did you want us to shoot you?" Defense counsel then did bring out. He asked questions. He said, "Well, why did you ask that question? Was his behavior consistent with somebody who wanted to be shot?" So then, in fact, and in another place in the statement, the defendant denied going for the gun. So it seems to me that the attorney wanted to get some of that information in, try to show that the officers thought he was trying to get them to shoot him, and that wanted to get his denial in there. And also knew that whatever else was in there would come out during the cross-examination of the defendant, whom he had to call, otherwise he would have no defense.
But how do we know what the trial strategy was or would have been? I mean, that's one of the difficulties.
We don't, Your Honor. I mean,
we have this record, and there's a perfectly sensible reason that's apparent for the approach counsel took. But then, you know, we're admonished not to cook up after the fact justifications.
I apologize for perhaps reading the issue too narrowly, but I didn't think we needed any testimony from the attorney to explain why he did it, because, as already pointed out, the motion to strike the knife.
Right, and, you know, the argument by opposing counsel is, well, but that, you know, if you move under Miranda suppress, it casts the case a whole new light, and, you know, different strategy, perhaps different outcome.
Yes, sir. Well, and that's why we don't have anything from the attorneys. I thought the issue was narrow enough to dismiss it.
Well, and we've all struggled with these habeases that you kind of throw everything into the tube and fire away, and we're trying to parse out what the claim actually is. So you're not alone in that regard.
I would suggest, you know, if the court feels that, in fact, it needs more testimony, it might be appropriate to remand. But I think that, in fact, the prejudice issue is you know, well taken. I mean, the evidence came out. You know, came out when the petitioner testified. We have evidence, clear evidence, that the officer saw him going for something under the seat. In fact, the Commonwealth attorney in his closing argument played the tape and said to the jury, you heard him say he went for it, he went for it, he went for it. That's at 459 of the appendix. So we had plenty of evidence that would show that, in fact, he made the intent is clear. But his statements certainly satisfy that. The only question is the overt act. And in your Herring case, you pointed out that you didn't have to be in a situation where you're, in fact, pointing the gun at the victim in order to show the overt act. The trial court looked at this when it was addressing the motion to strike. And it said, well, maybe prepositioning the deadly weapon is not an overt act. But he then invited the officers in, placed them where he wanted them, and then sat down on top of the knife. He said, that by itself might be enough to demonstrate the overt act. Additionally, here we had the fact that he was, in fact, going for the weapon in testimony from the police officers. And I think that testimony, if it's accepted, and the reason why it shouldn't be accepted, would certainly be enough without anything from the statements. And in fact, the statements were there anyway because he decided to testify. So it seems to me it'd be hard to find any prejudice here once he decided to testify. The statements were coming in, and he had to come in. He had to testify because, in fact, there was so much evidence of his guilt on that tape that he couldn't let it sit that way, and he had to explain, make this defense that, well, I was trying to get them to, I was trying to get them to think I was going for it because I wanted them to shoot me. And I think that in light of that defense and the fact that he so testified, everything came in that would have been kept out if you'd made a motion to suppress at that point. And that there would be the outcome could not possibly have been any different if, in fact, the motion to suppress had been made and the statement had been kept out since he was going to testify. And for those reasons, I request that the decision be affirmed.
Thank you. You have 4 minutes and 24 seconds left.
Yes, sir. Just in response, with respect to asking the attorney to write an affidavit, Mr. Witt, when he wrote out his habeas and he starts explaining there are four reasons, he says the petitioner's statements were used against him at trial and he believed without that he could not have been convicted. And then on page 507, he says the officers questioned him without reading the petitioner's Miranda rights. The statements were made through a violation of the Fourth, I don't know why they keep saying Fourth Amendment, Fifth, Sixth, and Fourteenth Amendments, thus they are suppressible. C, exhibits an appendix to view officer's testimony at trial about not reading petitioner's Miranda right. If petitioner's counsel would have seen to it, the suppression hearing took place or soon thereafter, then petitioner could not have been prejudicial toward counsel error. There is much reasonable possibility that the trial would have resulted in a different outcome. But he references this issue. He talks about this issue. He's raised it at least two different places in the pleading. I respectfully disagree that the trial counsel, we can assume that he knew he had to call Mr. Witt. If you listen to that tape, you have a gentleman who starts off somewhat calm and then gets erratic. He's upset. He's angry. He makes statements like someone's going to die. And then I think the argument can still be made with respect to his behavior that day. If that's the argument, if that's the fact, that it's going to be suicide by cop, I think you can still raise all those same issues without calling him as a witness. And we have no explanation of why it is that this wasn't pursued. We just have a kind of bare-bones affidavit about how Mr. Witt seemed very intelligent. He insisted on taking part in a lot of the decisions. He went for it, that tape. That's contradicted to some extent by the officer's testimony that he was reaching towards the back of the cushion, which is not where the knife ultimately was located. And then with respect to the Herring case, in that case, the gentleman was actually holding the gun. It wasn't that he was reaching for it. It wasn't the issue that he hadn't pulled the trigger yet. So for all the reasons I stated earlier, I'll just ask if there are no further questions, ask the court to grant Mr. Witt's motion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.